Chapter 11, Pia Marta, in George's first person. I thought it must have been Claire's sensing some threat through her Pia Marta, tender mother, the waterproof membrane most intimately protecting the meninges and spinal cord, that made her qualify aloud. Sometimes mothers stoop to panic for a good reason, in the middle of Smith's sentence. If he remembered that we had witnessed his last wife Brioni's destruction at his hands in Janolan Caves, it was tonight so far a tacit subject, even for Claire. But she took advantage of his misogynist focus on me to persist with a subtle interrogation. I think seeing that his eyes being elsewhere made his responses to her peripheral enough for perfunctory honesty. But she had seemed so discomfited when his eyes had suddenly met her objective scrutiny that now, as soon as he would begin to look in her direction, she instantly lowered her lips and pressed them onto the top of Corbin's head, eyes downcast like an autistic Madonna. Her response was so quick that I don't think he ever realized that her gaze was still inspecting him. I think she did quite like the look of him. He had a pleasant, urbane, greed-matured visage, but if there was any need to combat him physically in some gun-free arena, it would be more likely her than me in combat. Perhaps that was why her Pia Marta was prickling. Claire looked at me as if she was imagining a situation in which I carried off Quentin, as I had Nanelle, and she interposed herself to ward off Schmidt. She asked him, "Is Quentin here?" He said, "In the car, but she doesn't want to come in. She has asked me to explain to you that she wishes to stay here with me and that she understands the full situation. She says it is good that you are here because you have seen our circumstances and you can reassure her mother that she is safe." Nanelle asked, "I've never met her. Can I go out to the car?" I frowned as I wanted all my lambs in one Glock-protected fold, but Schmidt opened and shut his hands permissively, and Nanelle strode outside, her fists still winged wide in her sleek coat pockets. When she opened the door, the Russian winter rushed in on us like a triumphant child. Claire did not seem to think there was any real reason to go out to the car. Clearly neither she nor I sensed that either of the young women was in any danger at this moment, despite my general control misgivings. I think she intuited, as I did, that there was still some crucial piece of knowledge that Schmidt himself might yield. We both knew that if we spoke to Quentin in the car, she would just say what he had said she would, and be irritatingly convincing. Schmidt said to me, "You understand fidelity, Mr. Jeffries. You have been loyal to one woman for a long time. I have always wondered if such unions do last such a long time because the two are trying compulsively to solve some problem in their relationship." Claire's murmur interpolated at once, "Is there a problem like that between you and Quentin?" He chose the superficial, but it was still an uneasy shallowness to master. "She is a fit young woman. I am an ill old man." Then he apologized to me. "I did not mean to insult the quality of your devotion." I said, "It's all right, language isn't your first language," grinning enough to diffuse my own accuracy. We both glanced at the guns on the table. I thought he must have adjusted enough to Australian mannerisms to feel accepted by my use of male banter, although I would never consider insulting him as much as I insulted Assistant Commissioner Harry Terence in Mount Druitt. I suddenly missed Mount Druitt. I knew Claire missed it all the time. But I was also obsessed by my own recent epiphany that superficiality is the vice and torment of old age, and that one must brace to fight it in oneself. I continued, "Just because I love Claire for all the wrong reasons doesn't mean that I don't also love her for what she might consider the right ones." He didn't look at her, but I did. For a second, her lips on Corbin's head not only pressed down but kissed him.